start off by prostrating myself in front of Ms. Aesop and saying that I apologize on behalf of this committee. I've done so privately to her already, but I want to do so publicly. I think it's the fifth or sixth time we've set this meeting. Every time she has graciously accepted, and every time she has been put off for some reason or the other. So we do apologize for that. Unfortunately, a chair of parliament sounds like a very, very, very lofty title. But in how many years have I been here? Since 94, so it's a hell of a long time. I've learned that you actually have absolute no power other than sitting here in the meeting and telling people what to do and not to do. Other than that, your program is not yours. Everyone else has to approve it and disapprove it. So I do apologize. I do not like treating people like that, particularly people that I know are very busy. I don't make a habit of doing that, and the committee doesn't either. So we really do apologize. But luckily we now have you. Unless an earthquake comes now, we're going to listen to you. And you know, I've already stated some of the reasons for this. Clearly, one of the issues is that Parliament has decided as part of its program that committees must engage with the National Planning Committee. So that's one item. We decided before that already to do this because I think it's absolutely vital with a structure like the National Planning Committee, which is trying to project visions for us into the future and what are the best paths for us to take. Obviously, the policies we make now affects tomorrow. So it's vital that we get things right now. Otherwise, you have to undo. It's like the old issue of undoing an omelette. Omelette you cannot undo. Once you've mixed those stuff, the white and yellow are mixed. But forget it. You can't change it. So it's very important for us to get those policies right. I mean, we have progressed in our sector on climate change much further than most other committees in the sense that we have already have a white paper and the committee has broadly endorsed that white paper with one or two issues which are not absolutely fatal to the document that we've raised. So we are much further. So it's very important for us when we have a policy already part of government, which already Parliament has processed. Very important to engage with the National Planning Commission. Firstly, to see what it is they are suggesting. Does it fit in with those policies, doesn't it? Do they go further in some instances? Do they not go as far in other instances? To engage on those kind of things, to see where we want to align ourselves within the argument on those issues. So that is vital. So obviously the climate change stuff and the transition to a low carbon is very much focused around that. But I also have been told by the department, because I haven't read this document, it's just too big for me, that there are other parts, almost in each other chapter, there are issues that impact on environment. So it's actually a bigger task we have than just the climate change issues. I mean, for example, there is the very controversial issue of fracking. That we need to look at and engage with and so on. So really it's for us a start of engaging the National Planning Commission, but also to try and see how how the different policies that already exist, how they fit into that or they clash with that. So that's what we want to do. So I've also asked the department to give us a summary, and as efficient as this department is, they have a few slip-ups there, but usually on efficiency they're quite good. Already we've asked them just for some comments where, you know, what it is we have to look at and so on. So you will have a document with you, dear comments, that will help you also in processing this matter. So welcome to Ms. Aesop and her team. If you can introduce yourself, and then we give over to you to make your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, members of the Standing Committee. changes in schedule. I understand that at that time of the year, there's lots of things happening. So, and thank you, Chair, for your personal apologies around this matter. I appeared before the committee last year, just ahead of the launch of the plan, and presented some initial, I suppose, directional issues related to specifically the piece on transitioning to a low-carbon economy, but highlighted some of the diagnostics that emerged out of that phase of the development of the plan. And we had agreed that I would need to return to do a presentation on the plan itself. So thank you. This is the follow-up of that meeting. And I'm sure that honourable members have, in fact, looked at the plan, and I agree with the chairperson. It is quite a document to go through. But certainly, I do hope that members have managed to look through this. The presentation that I will do for the committee today is a broad one. It deals with the background. It looks at some of the issues related to a number of areas in the plan. But what I'll do is move quite quickly through those and get into more details around the low-carbon transition piece, the issues of infrastructure, etc., that I'm sure the committee would want to engage with in far more detail. So, Chair, if that's okay, that approach is assigned with you, I will go ahead with the presentation. Good. So, by way of background, again, just to remind members that the Commission was appointed in May 2010 by the President, and our mandate was to draft a vision and plan for the country. Our role is advisory. And this plan will go to Cabinet, I believe, in June or July, June, and is currently a draft. And I need to remind members that this is a draft plan. It is open for comments. The commentary period is open right now, and will close on the 11th of May. So the committee, I'm sure, will be putting in a number of comments, and now is the time to do so. We released a diagnostic last year in June, and again had massive engagement throughout the country around that diagnostic to get a sense from the citizens in the country and stakeholders whether we were identifying the real problems reflected in the country. And then on the 11th of November, as promised, 11-11-11, we released the draft vision statement and the plan to the country for consideration. And essentially, we had chosen to entrench the values of our constitution in the plan. So you'll see that there are a number of the constitutional imperatives that will be informing the plan throughout. I'm not sure how many members of the portfolio committee read the very poetic vision for 2030 in the plan, and I encourage members to do so. So I'm not going to read it, but there's a, we had appointed independent, poet or writers to try and capture in an inspirational way the vision that we had come, or the initial vision that we had come up as a National Planning Commission. So I'm not going to go through that here. The plan identifies a number of critical drivers of change into the future. So we looked at the trends going forward, what would affect the planning for South Africa, and what we needed to take into consideration as the Planning Commission. And so just quickly to go through that, we looked at the, you know, the geopolitical and economic west to east tilt. We're looking at further developments and innovations around interconnectivity, globally, of course, the whole phenomenon of globalization and the implications for that on all countries and South Africa. And then climate change has been identified as a driver of change. Technology and technology innovation, and then the resurgence of Africa as well. So we looked at these key drivers of change and how that needed to inform the way we plan for 2030 and beyond. And, of course, my focus would primarily probably be related to the climate change as a driver of change. We demographic trends as a key element that you needed to factor in to the plan itself. So by 2030, we see that it is predicted that population will reach about 58.5 million in South Africa. We see, in terms of those trends, that fertility rates will be declining. And this is something that is really important. It is a global phenomenon as well, urbanization. By 2030 in South Africa, 70% of our population will be urban. And in 2010, we believe we've entered what is called the demographic window, where we have a large population of young people. So, essentially, the commission has looked at in developing a long-term plan and vision for South Africa. We try to look at what could, in fact, lead us to that kind of transformation, and we thought through what we're calling a paradigm shift that is necessary in the country, amongst all of us, decision makers, stakeholders, and I'm going to present some of that thinking now. We believe that critical to South Africa is, of course, an active citizenry. We're finding that there's been massive demobilization of civil society, especially and citizens in general, and that engagement and active participation in the workings of the country is critical. Strong leadership across the board, so this is not just state leadership, and effective government as the centerpiece for shifting towards or transitioning towards where we say we need to get to by 2030. So we're needing to look at creating the conditions for that change, the opportunities, and what we in effect come up with is the concept of building capabilities, a concept that Amartya Sen introduced and we believe is applicable to changing and setting ourselves on a path to achieve these objectives. So how do you build capabilities, not just of the state, but of citizens and communities throughout the country? And to do, we need those to, in fact, look at the kinds of outcomes we want to achieve, employment, growth, poverty reduction, and general living standards rising into the future.
What ideas have we got around that? You know, I think we all agree, I think particularly in South Africa, we all agree that our citizens must be involved and so on. The problem is, the vast part of your population, their biggest struggle every day is to live. So for them, the last thing they are interested in is to then have further burdens put upon them to be in part of consultation. Has the Commission come up with any new ideas of how we do this? You know, I mean, the one thing at the very least you want to do if you want to consult, you have to empower people to understand the issues. I mean, to sit here in Parliament, as we do all the time, to send out a press statement to say, comment on, whatever. I mean, the only people that get involved are NGOs, the middle classes, and people with interest, to be quite blunt about it. NGOs come here, they say they talk on behalf of communities. I think, depending on each NGO, that will differ if it's true or not. The one thing I do know is when community organizations even come here, like say in the climate change area, and they come and talk about climate change, they copy a document of an NGO. They don't come and tell us here what the community feels. So, and I'm not blaming them for that. I'm happy that they participate. So this is not a finger pointing. I'm actually trying to think for us to, how will this country, if we are serious, how do we go a step further and I think be the first country ever to get meaningful participation by those communities and people that are marginalized? I mean, I think in this country, people that are equipped for things can have all the opportunities they want to talk as much as. But the point is, we're not reaching those people that are affected the most. So I don't expect you to answer it now, but I would ask that we put that thing very strongly on the agenda. I mean, we can just talk for environment and water, But I may imagine if we come up with some new innovative ideas, it'll affect things more broadly. So I really think for us to start meaningfully get our people involved, we have to change and we have to come up with innovative ideas how we're going to do it. I mean, if we don't do that, I mean, we basically are really just talking to the middle classes. I mean, you know. So I just want to flag that more than expecting an answer, because I don't know what the answer is myself. I mean, I at least know that we must find ways to go to people, to be able to engage with them, to give them the ideas. That we have to do, but we don't. I mean, we tried with the constitution making a little bit, to go there, explain things, and then the people came and said, okay, what are your views? That's the only time we've really done it. So, I want to flag that, because for me, in all the good things we do, if we don't get an answer for that, we'll always leave and have a very dissatisfied part of the country who have no voice at the moment. They just don't.
Chairperson, I mean, that is, it would be really good for the committee to grapple with this issue. So the issue of capabilities, when the commission talks about building capabilities, and that, as I said, should be individual capabilities, building community capabilities, building state capabilities. What is building capabilities?
Exactly.
Is the crux of the question. And if you get that, you know, you create the conditions, you create opportunities, but you actually build capability. And we need to define, you know, more thoroughly what almost a basket of capabilities would mean to have effective and active citizens and empowered citizenship and citizenry. So I certainly think that you've highlighted probably one of the most critical elements of the plan. And so this is part of, you know, if we're having a paradigm shift, we need to deepen our understanding of capability as the core. So all the other issues are things we've identified that need to happen by 2030, but the core, the success factor for that to happen, in any case, would be this as the central piece, I would suggest. And so you're absolutely correct, Chairperson, and I think it would be great if the committee did identify more strongly what they believe would be the critical elements of building capability. And we'll come up with the standard ones, of course, you know, education, basic services, housing, etc. But a committee like this would hopefully think and bring into the discussion more sharply all the other issues that affect capability and quality of life, etc. So certainly I think that is a critical part of what still needs to be discussed and looked at. And in the end, of course, building social cohesion as the overarching glue that holds South Africa together. So, I'm not going to go into detail about this. I'm hoping the committee has seen the animations on it was on YouTube, etc., about Thandi. And what the commission tried to do through telling Thandi's story, both in the diagnostic and then in the plan, was to use just an example of an individual and the experience of a particular, of course, is a representation of millions of others, and the chances, their life chances. So Thandi is this 18-year-old girl who completed matric in 2010, and we take a look at her life chances just in terms of school enrollment and matric, and then we define what would happen to Thandi in this period. So I'm not sure, Chair, if you'd like me to go through this, but clearly Thandi's life chances, given that we've not addressed the issues of opportunities, conditions, capabilities yet, there's a 13% chance that Thandi will get a pass to enter university. But then again, if you factor in the fact that she's an African female, for Thandi the chance of getting into university or getting a university pass is actually 4%. So a woman.
Well, this is such a perfect example of the fallacy that every year we look at the matric results, which are important, but it's not looking at the right issues.
Yeah.
I mean, the issues are how many people fall out of school, which if you look at the statistics, it's more than 2/3 of our kids fall out of school. It's not the people that actually make matric and get, which is bad enough when they can't get jobs, but and this is a perfect example.
even shows you that I mean, we're doing pretty well in terms of enrollment.
Yeah.
But the figure that you really have to look at is that 46% dropout rate before grade 12. And then, of course, the results, but then the exemptions for diploma entrance, etc. So Tandy's chance of actually getting into university is 4%. Then the chances of getting a job in the first year are 13%. So first year after matric. Not after university, because we're assuming she doesn't get into university. The chances of getting a job in the first 5 years after matric are 25%. The chances of earning above the median income, and here we look at 4,000 as a per month as a median, are 2%. Tandy's chances that she will not get a job in the 5 years after school for the rest of her life, she will receive periodic work for a few months here and there. So chances are that Tandy will remain below the poverty line of 418 a month for her entire life until she finally gets a pension. So that's the story of Tandy. And so we use this to really grapple with what we understand by creating the opportunities, the conditions, and the capabilities to address the Tandis of South Africa. We did this diagnostic in the last presentation. It looks, I suppose, prettier now in this one. So just to remind members that the Commission identified poverty and inequality as the critical challenges in South Africa. So that was it. We identified that as the critical challenge. And then there were a number of 9 other challenges that we identified. There are too few jobs, of course. We have crumbling infrastructure. We have a resource-intensive economy. The spatial divide, the old spatial, apartheid spatial divide still continue today, so we've actually perpetuated and maintained those divides. Poor education, a high disease burden, poor public services, corruption, and divided communities. So that's what we identified as the key challenges during the diagnostic phase. And then the way the plan has been developed is to look at these challenges and, in fact, turn it on its head to look at them. How do we address them? What would be needed to address each of those challenges? So the plan says we'd look at how we create jobs, how we expand infrastructure, how we use resources sustainably, transform our spaces, improve education, provide quality health care, build a capable state, fight corruption, and unite the nation. So the diagnostic, the way the plan has been developed, talks to what we identified as the key challenges in the country. And in the end, we're hoping that we will achieve prosperity and equity. So we look now at these elements of the plan and just give a sense of the high level directions that we're proposing in the plan. So, Chairperson, again, I need your guidance. This can be pretty long. I'll go through it, and then please feel free to tell me I'm spending too much time on something.
No. I think go through it, and we need to get a good grounding of what affects the environment. And if you don't put the pieces together, it may not be able to understand it. So I think let's go on and stop.
All right. So in terms of trying to achieve the objective of creating jobs in the country, dealing with unemployment, the Commission, of course, identifies growing the economy and making it more labor-absorbing as the critical objective here. And in order to do this, we've identified a number of interventions needed. So lowering the cost of living is one way of dealing with this, and of doing business. So lowering costs that can then stimulate job creation. Increase infrastructure spending to 10% of GDP. Again, promote competitiveness and exports, diversifying our trade towards the emerging economies and not just the usual trading partners that we have. We've discussed very intensively the next point. So how do we exploit our existing mineral endowments to pay for capability upgrading? So in other words, the capabilities that we will identify as necessary to have a successful outcome in the country. So that's the other proposal, that we promote manufacturing in areas of competitive advantage, that we grow agricultural output and focus on agro-processing, that we improve the functioning of the labor market to make it easier for young work seekers to get jobs, and then to make it possible for very skilled immigrants to work in South Africa. And before I go into the next, these are the proposals that have come up with in terms of stimulating job creation. But maybe to contextualize this, when we looked at the economy, we also looked at it in the form of a matrix of options. And we found that what drives growth is not always good for jobs or for reducing inequality. And we wanted that to be explicitly stated, that often we have found examples of increasing growth, but in turn, we've not seen that there's been a result in terms of reducing inequality and actually creating jobs. But we need growth to sustainably raise living standards, and we need jobs to reduce inequality. So that's what the Planning Commission suggests is necessary to deal with our current economic dilemma. And then we looked at the different options, and of course, again, it would be useful for the committee to come up with their thinking around whether these are, you know, they are, we've got the kind of assumptions right, but whether or not we are positioning them to stalk a polarized, polarized way of looking at the options. So good for growth, not great for jobs. So we said, well, mining, exporting, management services, high-skilled services exports would be good for growth, but not necessarily great for jobs. If we looked at what was good for growth and good for jobs, then we would need to look at labor-intensive manufacturing and mid-skill service exports. If we wanted to look at what was good for jobs, but not necessarily great for growth, then public employment schemes, home-based care, retail sector growth would be the options to go for. And then if we were looking at what was going to be bad for both jobs and growth, and the Commission proposes that a rising public sector wage bill wouldn't be good for both jobs and growth, low levels of investment and falling education standards would be really bad for jobs and growth. So that's the positioning of what we thought is the economic dilemma that we're needing to deal with. So, I'm now going to deal with the chapter on transitioning to a low-carbon economy. And I'm not sure if I probably did say this in the presentation I made last year, that the approach to dealing with the low-carbon economy and how we plan for the low-carbon economy in the first draft of the plan would not be that plan yet. We are not ready to develop a detailed plan to transition to a low-carbon economy. It's going to take a longer process than just 1.5 years, and in fact, we spent the time engaging with stakeholders just to deepen our understanding of the issue, to find out how sectors and stakeholders viewed this issue, because this is both complex and difficult. And of course, there are massive vested interests, especially in this country. Our addiction to fossil fuel is quite high, and so certainly this was going to be a very difficult piece to deal with. I do also want to alert the committee that this chapter is, in a sense, is not, you'll find it if you've read the plan, there's a lot of contradictions. itself to the energy piece, the energy chapter, so I'm hoping members have read that, and I'll do the highlights of that as well, and other pieces of the plan. It was really useful to get the comments of the committee around this. We've received the department's comments on this, some very robust commentary, and certainly during this period we would have to look at how we iron out contradictions or potential differences in the plan around this. So for this round of the plan, the chapter was really focused on a high-level bedding down of the concept of transitioning to a low-carbon economy, identifying what the critical challenges would be for South Africa, and some very high initial high-level proposals on how to take the work forward. So the work really will be, it's not complete. It's not going to be finalized when the plan goes to cabinet, and there's been an agreement that this area of work will have to continue, and there's a work program to in fact do that. And we're hoping to do this with the department as well, to look at what role the Planning Commission will be playing, especially now that the white paper has been gazetted, and to what extent, you know, we don't want to duplicate the work that the department, how can we be supportive and get alignment in these things. So as I said, the transition to a low-carbon economy, this work, this planning process is not an easy one. It's complex. This country, of course, we have high levels of CO2 emissions. Our economic development is absolutely hugely dependent on fossil fuels right now. And we have and still have significant coal resources, which we're not only using for our electricity generation, but we certainly, it's a massive export. And at the same time, again, just looking at, back at what we've just presented in terms of the conditions and our challenges in the country, we have unacceptably high levels of poverty and inequality. And so the process and the management of transitioning to a low-carbon and climate-resilient economy has to accommodate some of the challenges we face and the imperative of reducing and addressing the issues of poverty and inequality. And so this plan would have to be located within that. But we believe that it's key to look at both adaptation and mitigation. Now, this chapter does not deal with adaptation. And so I want to make that as an upfront comment. Members of the committee will see that. It is, in fact, very mitigation heavy, and certainly we would need to look at how we address the issues of adaptation going forward in the plan itself. It would come up in a number of other pieces, like when we deal with water, etc., but certainly this chapter does not deal with it at this point. And then there are a number
of... reason for that?
There's two reasons. One, that the elements of adaptation speaks to a number of other areas in the plan. So as I said, water, that would apply to agriculture, food, etc. And so the difficulty, and I should say this to the committee, about the process of developing this draft plan, and we've done a bit of a post-mortem review of the approach we took as a commission, just our learning curve on doing this, of course, is very steep, is that we took the route of getting commissioners to lead on areas in the plan. And what we did not manage to do in time was actually deal with the integrative elements of the plan. And that, I believe, is a fundamental issue that we're currently looking at. The fact that you have chapters in this plan, but the integration, again, the very thing that we as a commission saw as our mandate to break down silos, the plan does not necessarily reflect that. And that's why I'm saying you'll find some areas of contradiction. You're not seeing integration. If we're saying climate change, sustainable development, these are key cross-cutting issues, you will, in all likelihood, not find that integrated right through the plan, in the draft plan. So certainly the committee's comments on this would be more than welcome. And we acknowledge it. It was an area of weakness that we, just given the time frames, could not get to before the draft plan had to be released. So essentially, as I said, this continue to do work on this, and this is the broad direction or proposals that we will want to deepen our work around. The first one is, of course, very much aligned with the white paper, and we're really hoping to work together with the department on this, and that is adopting a carbon budget approach to planning for this transition. The second area that we looked at as a critical intervention, and again, this would be supporting Treasury on this, is to introduce carbon pricing, but specifically a carbon tax, and of course with rebates for the poor, so the poor consumers are not going to be affected. And then, interestingly, in the stakeholder engagements, one of the proposals that came up through those discussions, and was quite interesting and new, I suppose, is the idea of defining, you know, we've got the Copenhagen Pledge as South Africa, and often that's viewed as a conditional pledge based on whether or not we get international support. And what the stakeholders in our engagements came up with is saying, well, we need to actually define a domestic mitigation ambition that is not dependent on, necessarily dependent on financial resources, and international financial resources, sorry. So this is an area that we'd like to explore further, you know, to actually understand what that kind of mitigation ambition could look like. And again, we want to work with the department as well in terms of that. And then, of course, scaling up investment in research and development in terms of new technologies and where we could potentially have competitive advantage is something that we would certainly have to look at. So these initial proposals, as I said, are still at a very high level. This needs much more detailed work. And, of course, I suppose probably as importantly, very, very thorough stakeholder engagement. There are interests that if we are not going to keep people involved and engaged in solution seeking, that will resist these proposals. And as you've already seen, both when the department came out in the white paper process, Treasury with its proposals, the massive resistance to these proposals in the country, and we really need to look at ways of getting people to reach consensus about an approach. So the detailed work will continue over this next year, and also consultations around this will continue. And now, on the expanding infrastructure element of the plan, we looked at energy, and in terms of coal, we proposing, the Commission proposes, that we forge a compact between government and the coal industry leaders that would look at balancing the domestic coal needs with the export requirements or the export opportunities. That there's a proposal to invest in new heavy haul rail corridor to the Waterberg coal field, that the strengthening of the coal line to Richards Bay is looked at and invested in, and then to promote cleaner coal technology. The second area is related to gas. And here, Chair, the issue that you raised earlier, the Commission proposes that, that to enable exploratory drilling for methane bed and shale gas reserves. But this exploration has to be dependent on environmentally safe technologies. And then the other proposal in relation to gas is to develop infrastructure for the import of liquid natural gas. In terms of liquid fuels, to upgrade refineries to meet clean fuel standards and import refined products and consider deferring the decision on the building of a new refinery. These are the proposals in relation to energy infrastructure. Continued in terms of electricity, to expand on-grid electrification to 95% of households by 2030, to reduce carbon emissions in the supply of electricity, to transfer ESCOM's planning, power procurement, and purchasing functions to an independent systems operator, and then to evaluate the costs and benefits of nuclear as an option. In terms of water, the Commission is proposing a review of the National Water Strategy by mid-2012, that we put in an investment program for water resource development and wastewater management for major centers by 2012, that we use regional utilities to deliver services where municipalities are weak, and then to reduce water demand in urban and rural areas. Those are the proposals in relation to energy, electricity.
Anything on sanitation?
Not specific
waste.
Chairperson, but in the details of the chapter, not in the PowerPoint presentation, but certainly in the chapter itself, you'll find that. Okay. So then we looked at the spatial divides and how we transform space in South Africa, so transforming the urban and rural spaces. And the proposals are to move directly providing houses to fixing the gaps in the housing market.
You left out the transport sector.
Is it? Let me just check if it comes later. It comes later.
In this slide.
Oh,
first.
Wait.
That's okay. Then it's fine.
No.
Come back.
The slideshow doesn't actually have the transport. That's quite curious.
The one that says transport, vision, and
reality. Yeah, it comes during the infrastructure presentation, and it didn't come up. It's on the printed version, and it's not on the... Can we talk to the printed version then? Yeah, I'm not sure why this has happened. Is it hidden? There's such a thing as a hidden slide. Okay, all right. Sorry, Chair. So if on the printed version, you'll find the other elements of infrastructure. Transport. The proposals there would be to upgrade the Durban-Gauteng freight corridor, to build a new port at the old Durban airport site, expand the coal, iron ore, and manganese lines, and improve commuter rail fleet. In terms of ICT, we need a full policy review in the ICT sector, and we need to ensure that there's a more comprehensive and integrated strategy, that we need well-resourced regulatory agencies able to encourage market entry and fair competition, and to regulate market failure, that we need to target the training of what's called e-workers and e-consumers to grow services and stimulate employment, and that we ensure access to low-cost, high-speed bandwidth with open access policy. So those are the proposals in relation to the whole basket of expanding infrastructure, and I apologize that it did not come up on the slideshow. So, Chair, I'll move on to the transforming spaces proposals. Again, so what we're proposing is that we move directly providing houses to fixing the gap in the housing market, strengthening local and community-based planning capacity, and facilitating provision of a full range of housing types. That we ramp up public transport infrastructure significantly. So the issues of mobility in these spaces become critical. That we support local incentives to move jobs to townships, to encourage economic activities in townships, and that they break this kind of dormitory situation that we currently have. That we shift more resources to upgrading informal settlements. That we need to address the existing fragmentation in spatial planning. So this is at the government level, the different roles and powers and functions of different spheres of government in relation to spatial planning, and I'm sure the committee knows that there's a whole, I suppose, the legislative reform process underway. And that we facilitate security of tenure, especially for women in rural areas. And so we looked at certain proposals for strengthening the rural economy. And here we suggest that there has to be a substantially increased level of investment in irrigation, infrastructure, and logistics to link farmers to markets. That, again, we create security of tenure for communal farmers. That we improve and extend skills development training in the agricultural sector in partnership with industries. And that we look at ensuring sustainable production on these transferred land by making sure that human capabilities precede land transfer. a number of suggestions about how that could happen potentially. And then the final suggestion is to offer white commercial farmers and organized industry bodies the opportunity to significantly contribute to the success of the black farmers through mentorship, chain integration, etc. So those were the proposals coming out on transforming urban and rural space and economy. Now we turn to building a capable space. The first big proposal to make, and there are a number of suggestions under that, is to create a professional public service. And the three areas identified here would be that we ensure the public service is immersed in the development agenda, so that is their core function, but insulated from undue political interference. So let the civil service or the public service get on with the work they need to do and protect them from undue political interference. That we need to look at boosting the role of the Public Service Commission, and then a very concrete suggestion that we explore the idea of creating an administrative head of the public service. Secondly, that we are trying to look at ways of making the public service a career of choice, and so looking at establishing a government-wide graduate trainee program, creating career paths for technical specialists and local government civil servants. And then to look at improving relations between three spheres of government. And the suggestion here is to give metros a more coherent set of powers instead of the fragmented set of competencies that are now defined. We move on to the next area of the plan, dealing with corruption. And essentially we're saying that it must be tackled, of course, wherever it exists, but to ensure that it's tackled both in the public and private sectors. That we give the tender compliance office more powers to investigate its value for money, take legal and political steps to insulate anti-corruption agencies from political interference, that we increase the resources to anti-corruption agencies. We're proposing that we look at setting up a dedicated prosecution team and specialist courts and speed up these cases. That we look at centralizing the awarding of large tenders or tenders with long duration. That we make it illegal for civil servants to operate or benefit directly from certain business activities. That we introduce restraint of trade agreements for senior civil servants and politicians, and that we expand the protection of whistleblowers. So those are the suggestions, proposals being made in the draft plan on corruption. And then we turn to transformation and unity. And here we are proposing a few things. That we encourage all South Africans to learn at least one African language, that we revitalize our rural communities, that we look at using the Bill of Responsibility as a pledge by all South Africans to live the values of the Constitution, that we review black economic empowerment to ensure the objectives are achieved more effectively, that employment equity should continue and be strengthened, and that we promote values of a caring society. And then to get back again to where we started, to then again look at whether or not we're achieving what we said at the start is required in terms of a paradigm shift. Are we creating the conditions through the proposals in the plan? Are we creating the opportunities, and are we creating the capabilities that will lead us to those outcomes that we said we would like to see, and underpinned by the elements of the active citizenry, strong leadership, effective government, and overall social cohesion. And we believe that together we can improve Tandri's life chances, and that what we need to do is to deliver on all aspects of the plan and adopt a pragmatic approach, but be also open to experimentation, so not be completely risk averse. 2030, Tandi's life chances and that of her children will be better. And what we would want to see, therefore, by 2030 is that there should be no one living in poverty. That 80% of our children will complete their 12 years of schooling. That the proportion of youth who get into university should rise to 30% and into further education training colleges to 25% from the present performance. That the proportion of people working will rise from 41 to 61%. So, I mean, 41 per 100 to 61. The unemployment rate will fall to 14% by 2020 and 6% by 2030. And that 2 million people will be employed in community and public workshops. This is what the Commission says we would like to see through the interventions and the plan as a result of targets that we set ourselves for 2030. So in terms of the process going forward, again, as I said, this is a draft plan. It is being considered now. There are wide consultations happening and will happen throughout the country. We will be refining the plan based on these comments that we receive and submissions that we receive and doing a bit of redrafting. And it will then go to Cabinet for final approval, and then hopefully there will be successful implementation that would require, of course, broad support throughout the site. Thank you.
Thank you. The chapter on low carbon, I mean, we have a policy now. Government's adopted the policy. Parliament has broadly approved it with one or two things we've added. Isn't the easiest way to deal with this, for people to understand it, to take that policy document and pull out the policies in it, where the Commission agrees with it, where it doesn't agree, to say we don't agree, we should go in this direction, or we think this is not enough? I mean, wouldn't that be the more simple way to deal with it? I'm just thinking of, I mean, where we've got policies to reinvent the wheel, takes a huge amount of time, whereas we've actually, I mean, got broad consensus. I mean, there's very few people that disagreed when they came and spoke on the white paper. I mean, even business was, of course, it was an organization of business, but who represented business. I mean, doesn't mean every businessman will feel that way. But I mean, the noises that came from business were absolutely positive and encouraging. And if not saying, well, we know this is where the wind's going in any case, there's no use, we're trying to swim upstream kind of thing. So I'm just trying to think on that chapter whether there isn't just much more substantive stuff where there's already huge buy-in, where one can just take it forward and actually just highlight where the differences are. That's one thing I would want you to address. But I thought maybe what we'll do we quickly want the department to highlight what it feels are just the major issues the one Ms. Isop has already highlighted. I mean, on adaptation, it's not been dealt with, so I mean, that one we can just jump over. But maybe that'll help the discussion. Are you going to do it, or Ms. Bowman, you can do it, Ms. McCord? But Ms. McCord, I don't want the input, I mean, this is a long input. What I don't want, what I want is to just say to us, we would have liked something said about adaptation, which is not there. And whatever else, I haven't read this document, so I don't know what else you've got. But literally, I want bullet points just over. So that just helps us to pick up on those issues and equally helps Ms. Isop to respond to them.
Thanks, Chair, and apologies for the DG and Ms. Beaumont had to leave because their item is apparently in front of Cabinet now, so we may still have the other input today still, Chair. I think the just a bit of context in terms of process, we already, as Ms. Isop has indicated, had a detailed workshop with the Commission plan, as well as expressing these areas that we really appreciate the thinking that has gone into this. And we also have promised that by the end of this week, we will provide them with our detailed analysis and concerns, which is the word version of the presentation that you've seen, and we are busy finalizing it in this week still. Then we are also participating in the cluster discussions on this, specifically the economic and infrastructure cluster inputs on this. The department is also participating in that, leading to the cabinet process on this. In our assessment of the document, and I'm not going to dwell on the areas of appreciation and agreement, because you know there are many of those areas, but rather about the areas of concern. Chair, you've mentioned the issue about adaptation. With us, there's an even broader concern where environmental management or environmental degradation is generally equated to climate change. And the whole, while it is the other way around, actually, climate change is a part of the bigger environmental degradation and sustainable development regime. And that links very closely to the second part of it, is the absence of that integrative writing and thinking linked to the strategy for sustainable development in the same way as it should be talking to the policy. So we think the sustainable development strategy or thinking, the framework, should be the thread that forms this integrative writing between the different chapters of the document, of the plan. Then we also think that there is, like, not enough acknowledgement of the ecosystem services and the eco-based, the biodiversity as a natural resource in terms of, for example, rural development, in terms of the economy, in terms of the links to tourism and the importance of that being intact. And the fact that when we talk about natural resources, we are actually, and saying that the country is endowed with a rich natural resource base, actually limited to talking to mineral resources in this extent. While there are areas where we are not rich in natural resources, water, for example, being an example, we are actually natural resource constrained. And then there are areas that we are incredibly rich, more rich even than our mineral resources, which is not getting the adequate attention. For example, the whole issue of solar energy being the total coal base is 15% of what our annual solar resource is that we still need to tap into. And they're not even talking about the richness of the biodiversity. We think that that's also limited in, for example, the agriculture chapter, where there is a big emphasis on intensive production rather than looking at, again, that maybe be linked to the adaptation approach, in terms of looking at the wildlife economy as an agriculture sector that have tremendous potential to grow. And then also, again, linked back to the limited resources. Ms. Isop talked about the spatial planning and the inequity in terms of land use and access to land use and how this whole process needs to... We think that Chapter 8 is very strong in this regard, but that it needs to link back again, similar to what you're saying about the climate change policy, to the current process of spatial planning and land use management in the country run by the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. We also think that while they do speak very strongly to the areas identified in the diagnostic, there are certain little emphases that are missing. And one example would be in terms of the infrastructure falling apart, that we are talking extensively about developing new and additional infrastructure and not really focusing on the falling apart bit, which is the maintenance and what would be required in terms of the maintenance. There are also areas where we believe there are gaps that we can work closer on with the Commission, and that relates specifically to the vast marine territory that we have, which is much bigger than our land territory and is about to be expanded by the expansion of the continental shelf. And that have a whole lot of new both challenges and opportunities that need to be talk about planning of the country and of our resources and our people that need to be taken into consideration. And then also start thinking about offsets beyond the limited focus in terms of carbon offsets and climate offsets. We, for example, think that, as an example, and I don't want to dwell on that too much, but in the mining sector, if we talk about offsets, which shouldn't be confused with rehabilitation, which is something different, but offsets through a public works process where you have both benefits in terms of job creation and in terms of growth, which is something that in that diagram that they say good for growth, not great for jobs, that in that diagram would, for example, fit in very nicely. In terms of, again, back on the natural resources, the demand side management and the supply side management for water for specifically was identified as an area that could be strengthened, but we will leave that to Water Affairs to respond to more strongly. Chair, I think those are, and then also the discussion back to what we had yesterday with the committee in terms of these institutional arrangements and who does what. And Ms. Esip also talked about working with the department in terms of the policy and the carbon budgets, etc. But how do we fit the different processes into each other? And ultimately, if the plan is adopted, revised, adopted, where, how does the implementation work in terms of these issues of integration specifically? Yes, and then we found the contradictions, but I won't repeat what Ms. Esip said already, that there's huge contradictions between the infrastructure, the energy, and the transition to low carbon, but not only to that chapter, also to the chapter that talk about spatial imbalances. Those in integration didn't happen nicely, and they are actually contradictory processes. In terms of the whole energy mix, and in terms of, and I think I should just highlight this because you talked about it yesterday as well, Chair, in terms of the fracking, we had quite a heated debate with the Commission on this. And I think the two key points that we want to make in this regard is that...
In terms of what? Fracking?
Fracking. The shale gas issue. That it is only a better option if it replaces a higher intensity coal. So if you argue, for example, from a carbon perspective, firstly, I'll talk about the energy perspective later, or the environmental perspective, but if you talk about a carbon and you talk about that in terms of nuclear, it is less carbon intensive than coal, more carbon intensive than nuclear. But you cannot say it's a lower carbon trajectory if it doesn't replace coal, for example, in your projection in your energy mix. The second issue in terms of the environmental appropriate technology, there was a big argument in terms of that we're using fracking-like technology already in, for example, the mining of coal, where there is also of gold and coal, where there's similar type of processes, which is currently happening. And our argument in this regard is just, yes, the exploration could continue once we know that a risk-averse and cautious approach has been followed and that we don't have the similar impacts on aquifers that are currently still untouched in terms of water versus aquifers that have been very much compromised through acid mine drainage, etc., with these things. So I think what we are basically saying is that we need that work that that specialist task team is set aside to do to understand what the risks and the consequences are before we open up an untouched area to potential devastating impact. So we think those two things need to be addressed. Firstly, is it a lower carbon path if it does not replace a higher intensity carbon? And secondly, do we understand what it means that it needs to be an environmentally appropriate technology that, that is followed? And for that, we need the urgent work to be done so that we can then ultimately understand what the potential is. So, Chair, that's kind of the highlights of our concerns. We think there's great potential here, but there's also quite a bit of work to be done to do that integrative also to respond to what are the sustainability path of this in terms of the total definition of sustainability.
Thank you. That's very interesting. Obviously, Ms. Isop has pointed out that this is a document for discussion. She has clearly indicated that the Commission has already sat down because of time constraints afterwards, looking at it and saying, well, they can already see they themselves have not integrated their work. So it's no use us starting to say, well, this is clashing with that. I mean, they know that. What we need to do is try to harmonize those things when we go forward. And then as we see, the department already is in full engagement with the Commission. In fact, they're giving their response this week, at the end of the week. So that I'm all happy about. Obviously, I mean, just sitting here listening to the two, I mean, the first thing that strikes one is we're going to have to find a way where we look at the issue, obviously, from our perspective, and I think government's perspective, as sustainable development as the overarching thing. Then if you take something like a low-carbon economy, it clearly faces it below that, and we need to find ways to make sure that if we're only dealing with an aspect of sustainable development, we need to make sure that it fits into that. And I think that's one of the major issues that I hear the department already raising as an issue. So that's all interesting. But let's see if there's some inputs. Obviously, this is not a question of right and wrong, and we're not going to try and finalize anything today. This is just the start of a discussion. Ms. Manganya, Mr. Skosana, Morgan, Totetsi, Lala, Dr. Juan.
Thank you very much, Chair. Applauding even the Commission for bringing this for discussion so that we must be informed about what we can also give the input before it's... local government. And then because we don't go back and do look how many graduates do we have that can assist the capacity that we are lacking in the municipality. I look at the page 14. I don't see properly if I've got eyes.
Can I make a suggestion? I should have done it in the beginning.
Yeah.
I'm a bit worried. If we're going to go and look at all the other departments' issues, we're not going to be well acquainted with them. Can I suggest that we start with our issues, environment, water, and so on, and then whatever time we've got left, we'll go back to other issues if people want to raise issues. Can I suggest that? Because, for example, you just raised local government, schooling, and so on. That is not... I mean, we can comment on it, but it's not really our, you know, area of mandate. So I'm going to leave your questions on the table. So we've got them already. But what I'm suggesting is let's first concentrate on our issues, and then we'll come back to those. Can we ask you to concentrate on water issues, environment issues, and those things? Then we'll come back to your issues you've raised now. I'll give you another chance.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, sorry, with all members, okay?
Because I do it sequentially,
yes.
So it means I will come back because I didn't do it sequentially because I wanted to raise whatever.
No, I've allowed a broad input so we can understand, but I should have just said we should focus first. And then if there's time, we can talk as much on the other issues as we can, okay? Ma, I'm going to give you a chance to come back if you've got... specific issues on water and environment, so I'll come back to you. Mr. Skosan.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've complied to what you have.
Please, we'll come back to the others. We
yes,
there's
okay.
time, okay?
Chairperson, I just want to check with the Planning Commission in terms of a new system of energy, electricity. In fact, the solar system that we, in fact, we are anticipating as a country to assist in reducing the carbon emission from the electricity that we have. How is their plan? In fact, what is their plan in assisting this program to roll out so that we can fast track this program to cover the entire community, or if not entire, but half of the community before 2014? And secondly, Chairperson, the waste management in the municipalities. Municipalities are struggling a lot. Is there any plan from this department to assist the Department of Environmental Affairs in implementing this program? Even if we know that, Chairperson, the municipalities are having a broader mandate to implement this program, but they are unable because of financial problems and other resources that may be needed. But the Planning Commission, as an umbrella of all these departments, I should think it's well placed to assist with the plan and the plan of how to mobilize resources to assist those municipalities. Can I get a sense on that, Chairperson? And even water, the issue of water is a problem in this country. There are a lot of villages that has got challenges in water. In fact, circulation, bulk water, and whatsoever. What is the plan from the Commission side now in assisting the department? We do have a department which deals with this mandate. But the Planning Commission, broadly, with its chairperson, is this mandate in mobilization of resources, again, financial and so on. Can we get a sense on that? Thank you, Chair.
Honest account of how difficult it is know, we're having a discussion, so let me raise a few thoughts. I mean, the chapter 5 starts quite explicitly outlining the commitment, the 34% below 2020 and the 42% below 2025. The chapter goes on, obviously, to talk about the realities of our difficulties. I accept that it is what the current figure is. But I do wonder whether, and we've had many submissions in the committee before, whether the Planning Commission's job is to so explicitly align itself, bearing in mind you have got a bigger scope, with the particular commitments. And the reason I say that is because certainly in the near side of that commitment, I don't think it's achievable. And many people have come before this committee and said it's not achievable either. So, granted, I mean, you've probably just thrown it out. But you've done a very good job of saying how difficult it will be. I think you certainly have the scope to be maybe possibly a bit more critical of those figures. I think there's general agreement on the need for a peak plateau in supply. Hopefully many people won't contest that. But I do think that in the first instance, we should be a bit more thoughtful about that. You have the opportunity to dream and plan and envisage and all of that. It's a very specific executive target that, and I think some critical analysis of it would obviously be good. The other thing, of course, for me is are the contradictions. And as I say, you go some way to pointing out how difficult it is. One of the problems we have is that the ILP2 claims far more carbon space than it should be allowed. I mean, I'm told that it's probably more than 50% of the carbon space. So, your chapter has very cautiously outlined some issues around energy mix, and in some respects actually throw them out for future discussion and analysis. And I accept that. But the actual carbon space for energy, I think, needs a bit more critical analysis. The white paper isn't explicit on this particular issue, but if you interpret it and read between the lines, I think the white paper sits uneasily with the ILP2, and perhaps that is a good thing as well. With regards to infrastructure, and I'm moving slightly then out of this particular chapter, you know, the push for infrastructure is obviously a very good thing. There's a driver, does have multiplier effects. One of the things I think we need to more explicitly talk about, particularly with the President's drive for infrastructure, is how we build and how resilient the infrastructure actually is. About 3 or 4 years ago, when the world was in a significant financial crisis, in some parts are still, finance ministers of the world, the G20, got together and dedicated a huge amount of money towards infrastructure spending, which they tagged as green spending of sorts. And the idea there was obviously, one, to stimulate, but two, also to start investing in the lower carbon future. One of the things I remember reading and learning about at the time was the concept, of course, I mean, infrastructure renewal happens in every economy. Granted, South Africa had a shortfall of infrastructure, but structure is to the impacts of climate change, actually. Concept of, well, if we're going to build a new road, is it resilient for a 1-in-100-year flood or a 1-in-20-year flood, for example? And I think that that is, has probably even more resonance for provinces where you know, there are massive gravel roads. The vast majority of roads, in fact, passed the gravel. So the general point is, you know, are we, if we're going to build, and you know, are we going to actually specifically build the adaptation to, of climate change into the infrastructure projects so that they so-called climate-proof our economy? And I think the economics of it probably makes sense in the sense that, you know, infrastructure which is destroyed more often is obviously more expensive to renew. Do it well once, then that's a good thing. The I want to make a comment about water as well, and it's not an issue that's new to this committee in terms of the plan around water, and it's an issue which I'll raising in the committee. I think we need to be far more explicit about where water fits into the equation in planning, in the sense of whether it dictates what is feasibly possible in an economy, or whether in fact water provision follows the demands of other development needs. So what I mean by that, the President obviously has announced a big infrastructure bill which includes water. Now, none of it's particularly new with the exception of Mr. Boom. So, you know, it's not like this is suddenly a new concept, but it's something we raised, some of us have raised it before in this committee. The real question is, does water actually get a real place at the table of planning and development in South Africa? If, you know, do you put, for example, energy provision, Madupi, Kusile, nuclear, fracking, possible Mafuta, before, and then say, we will put in the necessary augmentation plans to get water there? Course, which there are opportunity costs involved, or does, for example, water going to actually dictate what those, say, for example, and I'm focusing on energy here, energy interventions are. So, I mean,
who wags the dog, the tail or the?
Yeah. So, what we might have asked a few years ago, you know, is there sufficient water for Madupi? You know, and someone else will come and say, well, of course you need Madupi. We need energy, you know, we're just going to have to make it happen. I'm not, my intent here isn't to say one is necessarily more important than the other. My feeling and my gut, after following a portfolio for some time now, is that water follows. And what I'm concerned about there, and which I think should be explicit in national planning thinking, is whether in allocating water we are getting the best productive use out of whatever the unit measurement is, gallon or litre. And I think we need to be more thoughtful of that. Going all of with this, and I know the Department of Water is doing a very good job of this at the moment, is the national reconciliation plans, which are done at the town level, provincial level, national level. And I think the work is good, and this committee has had the opportunity last year in July or in August, Victoria, to really look at the exceptional level of detail. Remember, as looking chairperson, I think it's particularly at the Free State, just as a way of example. It's very good. And then, you know, the gaps and so on, which need to be fixed. But the concept of reconciliation, of which the good work is being done by the Department of Water, and I respect them for the good work that they are doing. The concept of reconciliation planning, I think, needs far greater respect. And it links to my previous point. Is there sufficient water for this particular project? And I always think, of course, once again, I'm not taking sides, of the Madupi example, where, for example, Madupi gets a 95% assurance of water, and the farmers around and the communities around the Mokgolo Dam get something around a 50-55% assurance of water. Now, those are choices, no doubt, countries make. But the opportunity costs of water, I think, need to get far greater resonance in national planning. And I guess the thing that, of course, and I know the chairperson has very strong views on this, is that at the end of the day, what are the largest opportunity costs of water? I mean, who is not getting it? And I think here, particularly of then the water backlog for actually human consumption, of which there are still gaps, notwithstanding the most incredible efforts the government has made to roll out water to South Africans who previously didn't have it. But that is the biggest issue, is obviously balancing the economic requirements, energy, mining, agriculture, particularly, less extent manufacturing, and the needs of people who are still not definitely satisfied. So those things are very, very, very important. And I'm almost finished, Chair. The last part about that is, no matter how much water we have, and as I said, the reconciliation, all very good. The problem of, one of the big problems I have, which I think does also need to be very explicitly highlighted, is the fact that our dilution capacity in this country is very poor. We don't have enough water to dilute our pollution, which is a luxury other countries have far more. And the problem with that, of course, is without dilution capacity in a country, there's a general decline, and I accept it's localized, it's, you know, it's this area and that area, not everywhere. Of course, there's a general decline in quality of water, and poor quality of water is practically as bad as not having any water at all in an area. So things like cyanobacteria, nitrates and phosphates, fracking fluids, whatever else, all have obviously an impact there. So those, I'd love to obviously hear your comments more about it, because there's a lot of work on low carbon. I think there's less quality, less thoughtfulness about some of the other drivers. And yeah, I'd appreciate your comments and possible further discussion. Chair, thanks for indulging.
Thank you. Ms. Wenger.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for the presentation. Whilst we were talking about water and infrastructure and sanitation as well, has not been mentioned in detail, and I think it's very important for us to address those issues as far as wastewater goes and sanitation as well, because it is one of the main culprits of polluting our natural resources of rivers and so on, and also the overcapacitation of these various treatment plants and so on. And also the maintenance, for me, is a very, very important factor of the infrastructure, because the losses that we are incurring, specifically with the water losses, in some areas the municipalities are only able to account for 26% of the water, of the bulk water which they are able to pull. The rest is all disappearing into the losses and so on. I would like us to have a little bit more input into those things. Thank you.
Ms. Vigilada.
Chairperson, looking at slide 10, slide 10, bullet number 6,
I'll associate that one with climate change. We say water is life. It is life. And it is unfortunate that not much has been said concerning water, more especially for human consumption. Because of now late, there is a big cry. There are places whereby people are claiming they have been without water for months. Let alone that, well, my colleague Morgan has said enough about water. But I just want to add, thinking of people from the rural areas, those are the worst group. That is the worst group that suffers most. Because now, you find that they get their water from the rivers. Some of those rivers are not even running. You find that the stock urine is there. Alien plants there. Sewage at times just goes into the river. And poor people will draw the water some, you know, few meters away from where it happens. And you find that really that is disaster. Do we still say water is life? We cannot. Every human being is entitled to drink, to consume clean water. In fact, I wanted to refer to bullet number 6, slide agriculture, whatever. I'm saying, Chairperson, at least if climate change can be dealt with, life can be easy, better, more so for farmers. Those are the people that supply us with almost everything when it comes to food and whatever. Why I'm saying that climate change, if it can be improved, it's just that the floods, the drought, affects crops terribly. When there is drought, no production. Floods, they destroy. Well, it is just a pity because Chairperson, you have requested us not to ask the other questions except that. One other thing that I feel it concerns us, the chairperson did remark about it. You know, the oversight by members of the committee. Because I believe that when members can go out, meet the people, talk to the people, explain to them about certain things that affect their lives, they will respond. They will tell us about their own problems. Because I believe environment is not in M46 most of the time, or G26, or 475. Environment is outside. When the minute you pronounce the word environment, you think of trees, mountains, rivers, human beings, what you can name them. But I'm saying, it seems, but there is So we are forced to go ahead with the syllabus because the term is coming to an end, Chairperson. So you must just get to 201 Max Building, S35. You know, you run.
I obviously have to get you into the bush more often.
Thank you.
Taking over my chair. The only thing as a chair, the only power I've got is to point out people. Now you take that away.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Mr. Tetsi, please. No, Mr. Tetsi now. You've missed your chance. Mr. Tetsi. Dr. Fong has actually missed his chance.
Thank you, Chair. On human settlement, it is not clear as to how are we going to manage, you know, the contradictions and frustrations caused by informal settlement that happens on a daily basis, when on the other hand, we talk of rejoicing. I'm getting confused because
Dr. Fong is telling you you're on the wrong topic, right?
Yeah, there's more
concern on water and environment first.
I'll try to select those, Chair.
Okay.
How are we going to deal with the smoke emissions when we have the mass storming of informal settlement, and on the other hand, we talk of the development of human settlement? And also, when we plan, do we take into consideration, the immigration on a daily basis, people from South Africa, and also making use of our services? And the other one is that of my name. It goes back to what you said on education, that improving quality education, that mining, its nature is harmful to the environment, and we need, technology to deal with it, to take preventative measures. But you don't think we have much in the country, but where you talk about the improvement in education and the skills that you're talking about, nothing is said about improving on that area. And also to produce certain number of artisans per year, it doesn't say in which areas that we so highly need in order for us to maintain and have control of the environment.
Thank you, Mr. Tetsi. Dr. Huang, the magnanimous Dr. Huang.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I just follow for your indicator, for I'm a last one, so why I don't take over from my colleague. Thank you for giving me the chance. I think it's, I'd like to thank you for the MPC presentation. Regarding carbon, low carbon, this economy issue, yeah. I think you highlight that we have the high level of the CO2 emission. But I just like to show to my colleague and the chairperson. I think it's South Africa just joining for 25 countries. A meeting in the Moscow for the next week. This week, to against for this controversial European Union law. Yeah. I think this one is also the charge for this emission trading scheme for every flight to the European landing. It will be cost. If you don't pay this scheme, you will be paid 100 euros per ton for your emission. So I think this is quite a lot of money for will be transferred to the other airline is a passenger. So I don't know is now we highlight that we also hire for this CO2 emission in our country. And now we are against for the European scheme. Also is I think it's a minister with India and China and I think in the Brazil signed this agreement. Against for the scheme. Then I like it from the outside, so we are against the European scheme. Then how in future for our reduce our carbon emission? Then we still in future we still charge for carbon tax. So I like to get more detail for the I think this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I want to comment on the issue of pollution, especially in terms of open cast mines. As I'm from the rural, we're told that the open cast mine is the one that is more dangerous and polluting. So I wanted to know when we come with the plan. Did we put in our mind that even this pollution from the mines, not just thinking about the smoke or whatever, did we thought about this open cast mine? And then I thought maybe the commission will look into broader scope in terms of when they talk of, they speak of water. I thought they will say, they will come up with a plan to say, because in province X or whatever, because we don't have water, this is our plan. And then there was also, when they come with a plan, they will be maybe having something to say, the dams that we are having, they are like this, so this is the plan that would like to bring. So I thought maybe I will get something like that. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Those are the questions and so on around and comments around the issues more affecting our portfolio. So responses over to you.
Thanks, Jefferson. I think the approach I'd like to take is to see these, I mean, there were more comments than questions, and then answer those very specific questions. But before I do that, I think it's important, again, to make a few points about the Planning Commission and the role of the Planning Commission. I mean, I do understand that there is this huge expectation that the Planning Commission is going to be this big body that's going to implement things. And again, I'd like to remind the members that, in fact, we're not an implementing commission at all. In fact, we have come up with broad, directional, long-term proposals, but certainly we are not going to get into detailed planning because we see that if government accepts our proposals, that the departments then would look at implementation and the details of that. So certainly, you might find in the plan, because we ourselves as commissioners weren't entirely certain about how high and how detailed we get. So you might find throughout some of the chapters that we actually get into very specific detailed proposals, whereas in other areas we look at far more high-level directional proposals. So, as I said, it's been a learning process for us as commissioners as well to deal with this. And certainly it would be useful to get the thoughts of the committee about how high and how detailed you'd like us to get on some of these issues. But we certainly did not see our role as coming with detailed plans on waste management and sanitation in a particular local authority or a particular province, for example. So we didn't get to that level, but made high statements, high-level statements about the problem and the need to fix it. So generally, that's been the approach. So on the issues raised, Chair, just to start off with the comment you made about whether or not the National Planning Commission, given that there's a white paper dealing with the issue of low-carbon planning, whether we not look at, in fact, deferring to extent that responsibility to the department. And to be frank about it, this was in fact one of the questions I raised in our engagement with the department specifically, that we discuss whether, in fact, the National Planning Commission continues its work at all on transitioning to a low-carbon planning, whether we just support the department in the existing work or to address maybe complementarities where we could take up some responsibilities that can assist the department. But this is the engagement that we're still going to have about the role very specifically in relation to this area of work, transitioning to a low-carbon economy, and so certainly we'll get a better sense of our roles around this. I'm looking forward to that conversation. So yes, that is up for questioning, and we are also looking at it with the department. So broadly, on the issue of water, and I've taken on board all of the comments, and certainly we'll feed it into the process. I'm wondering whether or not in this debate we shouldn't be, you know, we identified certain drivers of change as the commission, and we did not, in fact, consider that water into the future might be a driver of change. And if I listen to Member Morgan and other members, is this something we might need to look at again? I mean, it's not just a climate change-related driver of the impact on water, but certainly water per se could potentially be a driver of change globally, and we're already starting to see signs of that. So I'm not going to answer questions. I'd like to, again, just respond by way of us thinking about this for debate and further discussion. So certainly on the whole area of water, there's a lot that we need to address, not just in terms of, you know, the balance between economic need and human need. Certainly that is a big challenge that has to be looked at. The quality of the water clearly is an important issue. And given that it potentially will be a scarce resource, the opportunity costs around that. And again, that brings us back to the balance between economic development and human need, basic human need. Now, when in the presentation I raised this issue about how we define capability, it would be, again, Chairperson, useful for this portfolio committee to identify those elements of capability. And so, you know, the basic needs for humans could be an element that is defined under capability, and would water, for example, be one of those elements of capability that we talk about it. So I'd like to take on board the comments, but I think it's a useful opportunity to also get everybody engaged in the discussion. The role of water in the future, is it a driver of change, and how do we, in fact, is it a leader or follower, etc. Those are elements of debate that needs to happen, and the committee, of course, it would be really useful to get their views and thoughts on that. On the issue of renewable energy, the potential of renewable energy and planning for it, the plan identifies renewable energy as a critical element and a critical, you know, path towards transitioning to a low-carbon economy, to address the issue of carbon emissions, etc. But we certainly did not. We then said, and there has to be, of course, high levels of investment, but we didn't say, and so this is how we're going to have to do it in the country. Again, it's the implementation element of it, but we certainly did highlight it. I believe, personally, not strongly enough. And again, I do want to indicate that there are very divergent views in the commission itself, amongst commissioners about these things. So I certainly would think that a plan like this, especially on the infrastructure side, would emphasize much more scaled-up investment in renewable energy. And I think we could have done that more strongly, certainly. So the issue of infrastructure investment, besides the issue of resilience, Member Morgan, I think that what we probably would have to also look in is something that I mentioned in the first briefing I did, and that is lock-in potential of investment. and all the announcements and some of the infrastructure proposals that even the commission makes, I think would need to address the issue of locking and how we're investing in infrastructure where we could have stranded capital in the end. So if we're saying, and we really believe we are going to be transitioning to a low-carbon economy, a more sustainable economy, there's investment decisions being made now that potentially lock you into a particular path that by the time we're supposed to achieve that sustainability or carbon emission reductions, we're actually not. And so you're either going to be forced to, what do they call that, mothball infrastructure, which is just stranded. And so I think in the discussion, it's not just about how we climate-proof infrastructure and do that through our planning, but certainly we have to already start making trade-off decisions about these things. So do we actually invest in, and we can give examples of all of the infrastructure projects that's already been proposed, where you
could potentially do trains with this size gauge or that size gauge,
You
build all your railway lines, then clearly investing in the future now, you build those railway lines, you're stuck with them.
Yeah.
There's a small gauge one, you're stuck with them.
Exactly.
So those are the kind of, you make decisions in communications.
Yeah.
ICT.
Yeah.
What standard do you use? Then you get locked into a particular one, your chance of expansion, then extra cost. So those are all the issues.
Exactly.
Fracking.
Exactly.
Fracking.
Nuclear. So there are number
of another fossil kind of fuel while you're telling all the others on so bad you go there. Well, maybe we have to, but then we must know what we're doing.
And that is, Chairperson, I believe the role that the National Planning Commission can play is in fact to present these options and say, well, these are the trade-offs. And I think that part of the process going forward is for us to apply our minds far more sharply to those trade-offs. We said we would do this. We try and highlight. There's some places that we have done this in the plan, but certainly we have not. Some of the work that we are doing going forward on the piece of the low-carbon transition is to explore more deeply the issue of the current investment in infrastructure and how potentially there'll be lock-ins in some of those investment decisions already. We're having a number of roundtables where we're exploring, for example, the mineral and energy sector and transformation within that sector in terms of carbon emission reduction. So we're exploring some deeper elements of the issues that we've raised through a number of stakeholder engagements and roundtables. And certainly, Chairperson, I believe that this would be really useful if we get the members of the portfolio committee invited to those roundtables as well to participate in already those discussions underway rather than, in the end we present something to you because they are valuable inputs that we would be able to benefit from. So certainly on the whole area of infrastructure, I think it needs another deeper look at the lock-in potential, the resilience that needs to be built in terms of planning for it, et cetera, et cetera.
Can I just say, the one thing that I do think around something like infrastructure, which I think from what I've seen about what the commission has done, is, and I suppose I suppose you guys are careful in terms of how you interact with government, but the one thing I think that you've not done is look at what are the obstacles in the way we deal with infrastructure now. In the sense of, let me give you some simple examples that we found. The issue of how we allocate budgets for infrastructure. So you can say all these things about infrastructure, but think about water infrastructure. Think about water infrastructure. Water infrastructure, money is given to national departments, it's given to local governments, it's given to water boards, etc., etc. Now, the problem is with that, is that if you don't change the way we do budgets, all these things we're saying about infrastructure is going to have shortcomings. Because simply, let's take a simple example, and the local government people hate me for this, but I'm not, you have to be friends with people. Water infrastructure at local government level, all issues of water that we fund through the fiscus, is done by way of the equitable grant, equitable share. Now, the equitable share is just a pot of money we give to a municipality. Those municipalities, most of them, are not spending that money on water because there's no obligation for them to do so. In fact, when we asked Treasury the question last year, Treasury tells us, no, we can't do anything. This is a constitutional issue. So I say, why? They said, no, because an equitable share is in the Constitution. I say, yes. But who made the political decision to give water spending to the equitable share not doing by a conditional grant? That's not the Constitution, it's Treasury. So if we do not look at, in water specifically I'm talking now, at infrastructure, if you don't plan centrally but implement wherever your power is, so we don't want to take power away from local government. Another one takes it away from them. But if you don't plan centrally, so you say, we're going to build a dam, number one, wherever we decide. Okay, this is Mzumbuvu Dam. Now, the infrastructure we're going to put in is our big in the department is going to get this money to put in pipes from here to there. Then, the local governments it's going to affect are Butterworth, Mtata, da-da-da-da-da-da. Their infrastructure plans must all form part of one infrastructure plan. So firstly, when Treasury looks at infrastructure plans, it must look at them holistically. Then it comes to the spending. Then we must change the way we give money for those plans. If we want the money to be spent on that infrastructure, we must say, this is for water infrastructure. You can't say to local government or to Mpumalanga provincial government, here's a pot of money for you, then they go and build a parliament. So all the planning you do centrally in the fiscus, and we do in the NPC, and we do in the departments, we do these things, but then the way that we implement it, we've created systems that don't work to implement that properly. So, you know, I sit and think often, well, how does Treasury look at this? If you look at this spending, you say, I want to see this amount of money spent on water. Do they ever go and check and say, but all these local governments didn't spend it on water infrastructure. They spend it on housing. They spend it on building a new building. They spend it on grants. They spend it on food parcels. It may all be important. But your plan about water infrastructure, is they're not coming to fruition. So the central planning of infrastructure without taking away the power, but to plan it centrally, and then to do the spending in a way that it gets spent on that infrastructure. You know, you can ask here, Ungeni Water Board comes here, we look at their balance statement. These guys have like 400, 500 million rand in banks savings. Now you look at this. KwaZulu-Natal is the most populous province. Huge infrastructure problems. But Ungeni is got 500 million, half a billion in savings. You say, but why is this? You say, no. Every year we come, we want an increase of our water tariffs. The department looks at it, they give the increase. They get the money. When they want to spend the money, let's say they wanted to spend the money to put pipes at Mzumbuvu or Port Shepson or something. Then they go to that municipality. That municipality has got no money to put in pipes. If they bring the pipes here, the water board, they've got no money to put in pipes from there to there. So Mgen says, then we don't spend it. Now, this is us in government, eh? We give tariff increases for them to put that pipe in. They're saving it all the time in their savings account because they can't put in the water pipes because the municipality hasn't got the budget for it. I mean, oh, we are just doing the most absolutely out. integrated thing on infrastructure, of water. Now, obviously, this committee now has got it much more clued up with it, and we're now trying to follow it through. But that's the kind of just basic problems that people, clearly, Treasury hasn't seen it. I think they now see it because we've engaged them. But clearly, until now, they've not seen it. That they just a simple decision by Treasury, that firstly, when we give money to the municipalities, we don't make sure that this is all part of one plan. So you give money for infrastructure, yeah, but the national government's got no plan to put infrastructure with that, you're giving the money to the municipality. And likewise, when you do look at the plan, you give money to do it, yeah, then the municipalities don't spend it. There is no systems in place to make sure that that thing works. So that's why I'm saying, I think that the commission needs to go and look at a few of those things. Where, in which departments do we need central planning but decentralized execution? So you're not taking powers away. Secondly, how do we fund those things in a different way than we're doing now? Now, there's our DG on water. I've already, the first time he came and saw me, I could see his eyes started boggling because I hit him on this issue over and over and over. Because the problem is, we're now sitting here a year later. I see no visible changes within government for us to change that. Now, either someone must tell this committee, I don't care who it is, but tell us you're wrong. You are wrong. The way you are seeing this thing is not like that. Take another decision, which I think you can make a big issue on. That man there, Fred Van Sale, came, gave us a lovely input on whether we're meeting the Millennium Development Goals in water. Beautiful input. He shows you from 1994 or whenever how we met these targets. And then suddenly in 1 year, these things just going down. It's all there in government. That department's got that information. Now you say to yourself, why is no one looking at this? And why is it suddenly that we're not meeting the developmental goals? What reports are we sending overseas if the picture that the department's got is that? Then you see it's a simple decision. Political decisions were made. You take sanitation away from water affairs, you give it to housing, and suddenly absolutely nothing happens to it. It's a complete decline because you have fragmented the power. It's a political decision. Somehow the people that made the decision are not getting the information, or if they're getting the information, so I really think those areas, when it comes to this infrastructure, I think the commission can make a big, big change. Because the problem is, I can see, having been in government myself, it just seems difficult for people to see that they have made mistakes. But not to see that they've made mistakes, but then to see how do we rectify that. It almost seems that it becomes absolutely difficult for people to change. And as I said to you, Treasury's first response, the young lady that sat there, was, it'll be unconstitutional. Absolute nonsense. So what it means is those staff members that feed information into the Treasury system have a wrong view of the Constitution and of what legal issues are. Now, if a structure like the MPC, where you're outside of that, I think it's very important that I'm not expecting you to go and look at the nitty-gritty of running those stuff, but simple stuff, for me, which is what a planning commission is, planning. How does the planning get done for water infrastructure? And then suddenly, if you get just one day, sit down and people tell you, you'll see immediately where the problems are. And then the funding of those plans. I mean, I think those two things in each area of infrastructure, whether it's transport, again, transport is provincial and national, so you can have problems there if you don't do it right. I imagine all those areas where that is done. So I just wanted to add under your input on infrastructure, I really think the commission can go quite far if it also looks at those approaches on each of the infrastructure areas. Sorry, you were still answering, Ms. Esau.
Well, Chairperson, that was a really, it's an area under, you know, we've had lots of explorations around building a capable state and try to look at the systemic issues, certainly. And this has been really useful as a very practical example of a systemic issue that could be simply fixed, actually. So thank you very much. That really would be valuable to add to, I suppose, some of the already, you know, the existing proposals. I
that the commission can play a critical role in doing that. Even if it came, there was a point at which I thought that the commission could just, if they just focused on the institutional and systemic issues, that could make a substantial difference. But thank you for that. On the issues that were raised by others around, I mean, I just want to again broadly categorize areas for further discussion and debate. The whole area of mining and the future of mining or the role of mining, etc., and the input that the department made in our engagement, that they've come up with this innovative idea of using offsets in the broader sense of the term, was actually fascinating and I think needs further exploration. But certainly, I mean, they're going to have to be, if we truly want them to transition to a sustainable economy, low-carbon economy, but in that, then they are going to have to again be difficult decisions. I mean, do we say that the, and this is one of the comments you'll find that the department made that I agree with, that you can't just take a kind of overall view that the entire mineral sector, all of the minerals that exist are endowments necessarily into the future. And that there are going to have to be winners and losers. And so who are they? And we need to get into that conversation about identifying who are the winners and losers in the mineral complex going forward. So certainly that needs a bit more interrogation. And to understand more explicitly what we mean, because the whole intention that the commission has around this is to say, well, here we have this existing endowment, but we've not effectively utilized this endowment to build the capabilities that we need for that future 2030. So how do we do that? And I suppose we've not really explored that in any detailed way. We've just made the statement that we need to unlock our existing endowments to build that future capability. But it would be useful to get further ideas about how we do that. And I know that the mineral sector is already getting, there are lots of debates going on about this politically as well, so maybe it's useful to look at that as a full, I suppose, basket of issues. As far as infrastructure, mining, water. Yeah, I think certainly... then the last issue that I want to raise around is the issue of the informal settlements, the smoke emissions, etc. These are, I think the Department of Environment, of course, plays an important role in that. We talk about upgrading and investing in informal settlements. Part of that would have to be access to electricity. And hopefully that kind of energy access and electricity access will reduce the kind of black carbon emissions that we experience from using wood-fired stoves, etc., cooking stoves. But certainly that's an area that the department would have to also address. I think, Chair, I might have missed things and the members need to identify that, but I saw the bulk of the inputs as areas for comment. And then I believe that there are still further areas that we need to engage in the debates and discussions around, and the hard conversations that need to be had. But lastly, I think that the issue of institutional alignment, the role that the NPC plays, the role that departments, and not just this department, but other departments play in relation to the NPC, that clarity, that role definition really needs to be sorted out in this year, because we wouldn't want to be duplicating any work that the department does, but we certainly can play a strategic role, I suppose, in the kinds of things that you've raised, Chair, but also those broader, hard discussions that require a conversation with the whole of South Africa. And
I think the thing that one was worried and what worried me when I looked at this stuff, it worried me that we could be sending out mixed signals. That's what worries. Because if government has committed itself firmly to a trajectory, even if we touch the little tag about we still want international funding. But I mean, if you look at it, we've committed ourselves to it without the tag. The tag is there, of course, because that's what the third world absolutely has to do, or it's going to get nothing from the first world. So, but if we don't pin it down, say, in this that we tie that down, the whole approach to carbon pricing, to carbon budgeting, to carbon tax, all the policy issues that we've already agreed to as a government, I mean, it's very important that for me, that the Commission doesn't set out a mixed signal, even if it's not intentional. But it has to say firmly, we agree with this policy of government. So this one we disagree because we think it's got this implication, it ties us into a kind of future issue that's going to create this kind of problems and explain. Then you're giving options, explaining. But that's what worried me about this, is that on this issue where we've now got, as Gareth was, as Mr. Morgan was saying, you've got two parallel processes running. Government comes to decisions on the one, and suddenly it looks at the other one's lagging behind. And I can understand why. I mean, the Commission is made up of a lot of people that are not in government. They represent other interests to tie themselves down. I understand all that. But there are some things that the Commission has to, where there are policies. I think the Commission must say, we agree with this policy, or we don't agree, these are the options for it. Not just in this area, I think in all areas, but in this area for us, it affects us quite strongly. So I think that's what really, for me, I would like to see that thing is settled. When the next kind of round goes, when it goes to cabinet. Because, I mean, the last thing you want to do is to accept, well, you know, are these policies, is this our future 2030 path or not? Government's got a policy, or this paper seems to not pin it down. And I think that's what really worries me about our positions on this. But I'm completely mindful probably why it's happened. I mean, you've explained one of the reasons. Chapter has to be done on its own. So when it comes to dealing with it, you need to take the path of the least resistance. How's your chapter number? I mean, it's obvious for me how the chapter won't go through with all those interests that are. So one can understand it. All right. I think we've got a bit of time for other questions broader than our topic. What's the time? Yes, I know we've got a ton of time. Mark started asking a few questions. I'm going to start with her again. Something that's just a bit broader, but let's try and stay on policy issues, okay? Let's not get too specific on detail, because clearly this commission is not going to report on detail. I mean, if the detail explains a principle, that's fine. But, I mean, they are not a government department, so they can't really explain to you why the road department builds two lanes and not three lanes, I mean, or four lanes. Why they build lanes at all, why they don't build only commuter transport. But the principles of, like Mao is raising certain principles on education, so that's, I mean, the whole focus of the education thing to, if you look at the Tandi example, you know, I want to go and read this damn report, but it's been so long, but I want to read it because when you gave the input and you gave Tandi's thing, they're a bit incongruent to me. Because on the targets you set, again, are the matric targets. What targets have we set for the 46 that fall out to not fall out? We're trying to get Tandi to go to university, and that's great. And the problem is in any place in the world, only 30% maybe of the population, at the best, in the most qualified country, will go to university. But the question I want to ask, for example, say on education. I mean, this whole issue of a skill-based education system, I mean, and we don't have that option. We only have an academic-based system. I mean, if you go and look at many of the countries that have had a strong development path, they went to look at the education system, they then created, I know Germany and Holland are specifically, they first were countries, very strong. In fact, the Holland one, as has been explained to me, is actually horrifying. Because at one stage they decide as a kid, you're going down this path, and then you can never get out of it. I mean, you almost have to go and shoot the president to get out of your one of the four paths they chose for you. And that's how really strong the system is. But that for me, you know, is not anywhere in the thinking, but for me it's a vital question we have to grapple with. Do we just, I mean, keep on going with this education system where everyone falls out of the system? But those are the kind of things that we have to get. Mom, it was you. Do you want to add to any of your questions?
I just want to say one thing only, because Chair, under transform urban and rural, whatever, I would like to comment on the shift more resources. I want to say something in terms of that. More people nowadays are moving towards, I don't know if the planning commission didn't look around this. More people are moving and from the village to the informal settlement, because government and whoever who's doing research, they focus more on this informal settlement. So people at the rural area, they don't get the attention of the government. When we talk about the rural, we're only saying we mustn't forget this. It goes in a slight, just a sentence. We must, women, rural women, it's when we think about the rurals. We will talk about the, we talk about the frame work of saying rural development. But when you look deeply into that issue, the focus is mainly on rural informal settlement. I think when we wanted to do the balance, we should make sure that we develop the rural, where people might not flood to go to the places where they're supposed not to stay. You will get more doi-doi because people are coming next to where they know that here the money is pumped for this informal settlement. I will get a house. When I'm in an informal settlement, I'm quite sure that I will get the house. So we must come up with some mechanism that will make people not to move from their own place to go and do the waiting list for housing in the informal settlement. Because it's a burden also to the government, the issue of informal settlement. But through our planning, I'm not saying to you as the commission, through our all the people when they are planning, we will find that they will give the people at the informal settlement, they will bring tanks and tanks of water to give them. But when it's in the rural, you won't see even one tank of water going to say, meanwhile, we are still awaiting to do 1, 2, 3. So I'm just throwing that relook on that issue because it's giving us problems. Thank you.
Good point. Mr. Tett.
Thank you, Chair. On the population growth, that will be 58.5 million by 2030, and also taking into consideration the fact that I've just alluded to about the immigration. Do we think 2030 is a realistic time frame for us to deliver what we plan to deliver by that time? And also on the development of urban areas, whereby we say by 2030, 70% of the population will be urban. It is not clear as to whether people from rural areas shall have moved to urban areas, or it is about the development of rural areas themselves, whether people shall be graded maybe to be urban areas. And on manufacturing, again, we usually see a lot of jobs come from manufacturing, but very often we downplay the transformation policy, talking about the ownership of these manufacturing industries, the development of SMMEs. It's all about jobs. It means others will forever be just job seekers and not do anything like the ownership of this small industry or at whatever level. And 30,000 artisans will be produced annually. I think the country runs short of engineers, especially mining engineers, and scientists, you know, just accountants. It's not clear
certain.
Thank you, Dr. Huang.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's I very appreciate the for the MPC make a long-term program. They highlight that 2030 is no one in the poverty. I'm very surprised. This is not a dream. Also, a bigger dream cake. Because it's 2030, only for 18 years later, not anyone in the poverty. So if you follow for the your program, you say the 2030 will be come down to the 6% unemployment rate. So 6% if 2030, like your MPC calculator is the total population is 50 at the minimum population. So 6% is means we still have the how many population for the store unemployment. So I think it's I quite happy for this make this plan. If South Africa 2030, no one in the poverty, I think it is a will be surprised in the world. I can tell you, yeah. Also, I will be congratulated for our MPC. But I'm more concerned for the actually not the 18 years later. I concerned for the now. Because it's a chairperson highlighted twice, yeah, from beginning and before he take a question for the member, for the Tandi life. Because how many Tandi is in at the moment in this country? Because you highlight for the large youth population at the moment. Then only for 13%. I don't know, it's a past two metric is how many population of for the least youth age is passed to the metric for this year and the last year. Then only for the 13% available go to the university. Then other 87% of what they're doing. They only metric. Say then you say it's a Tandy. He not pass to the university, go to the interns. Then he will be forced a year. He only get how many percent chance get the job. Then my question is, she only for pass to the matric, only finish the high school. What experience they have? How they can interns to the job opportunity? Who training for this young woman, young girl, young man? So I think it is a quite big issue for the national commission. How many is our youth is out of the school? Stole in the play in the outside the street. Then the crime is from this one start. So I think I like to bring your attention for this one. You say it's after 5 years, maybe you get the 25%, get the job opportunity. But that is one, the chairperson, I think this one, why is the more important for job creation, highlighted by the president. This is 2014, we will be creating 5 million jobs. Now, we are the 50 million population, close to 50 million now. Then only after 18 years, we increase 8 million population. So how many HIV and AIDS will be passed away every year? Since my understanding is KZN is every year passed away for the HIV and AIDS over 200,000 population. So I think this one is regarding the population, come to the your job creation and the special for the youth. So for Tandy life, I'm not quite happy for this calculate. Because you just say the happy side. On happy side, you didn't show to the committee say other 87% people unemployment that is youth, what's they going? They stay at home or stay outside the street. Then this I think this crime is how can balance. Also, it's chairperson is MPC highlight is like my colleague said, 2030, then is 70% the population stay in the urban, 30% stay in the rural area. Then you also must highlight indicator. What is 30% in the rural area? What economic development in the rural area in this period? I think it is quite important because all the people come to the urban. What is the urban can enough for is a job job opportunity for 70% population, everybody in the urban area get the job. Then the rural area, 30% is all the poor. Because you say 2030, not anyone in the poor. This is very important. I'm very concerned for 2030 in South Africa, no one in poverty. I take this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ikalala.
Chairperson, under environment, I'm sorry to take you back. I had this question. What makes the municipalities to become weak? And I was just saying, is it the inefficient funding or corruption? But you have dealt with that one already. Slide 8, Tandi's life change. Drop out. You know, if a child is sitting in a classroom, then there is a subject, mathematics, science. You find that the very same teacher, who is a lecturer or whatever, does not qualify to teach those subjects. He is not able to help the poor child just to go through the problem he has of not understanding these subjects. Unfortunately, it has been a sing song for years whilst I was still teaching. While JJ was still a teacher, but it hasn't dealt with correctly. Somebody has just made mention that we are running short of science, mathematics teachers. Well, I think something has to be done in a way just to try and then when the child is not happy with his or her mathematics or science, he just decides to run away from schools. As I say, the dropouts, they cause a lot of problems in the lives of our people as a whole at the end of the day. Dropouts. And one other thing, I think it is very important to look at the students in class, because some of them, they can be channeled to technicons, because you find that child is a handyman by birth. Channeling that child to a technicon, he gets there, he's trained for electricity, what you name them, as you know them. But now, one other thing, it has been the latest teaching from the government that children must not go for universities when they don't qualify. They must get to teacher training colleges. They must get to technicons. Then you'll be surprised. You'll get a wonderful electrician, and there are quite a number of them. I'm just trying to add to the planning commission just something that can help us getting less dropouts who becomes strict children at the end of the day.
There were so many. I don't know which one. Can I just say all those are good points? I'm not going to single any out now.
Thank you, Chair. I share your sentiment when it comes to the issues of local government, because the funding, particularly with municipalities, is something probably that needs to be looked at as a funding method of municipalities. Because what you have a look at the moment when it comes to water boards and municipalities, the financial years are not coinciding. The municipal financial year is from the 1st of July, while the boards are normally as from the 1st of March. The increases are always effective from the 1st of March. So the municipalities have to pick up that slack between the 1st of March and the 1st of July. So therefore, it's funding that they have to foresee in their budget to cross-subsidize, which should not be the case. I think all those increases should be effective as from the 1st of July, coinciding with the municipal financial year and not with the water board's financial year. And I think that has been something that has always been a major problem in local municipalities. And specifically municipalities where they do not have a rates income, where they're dependent on grants. A lot of the equitable shares, and I mean all of them are linked to indigencies, a lot of the municipalities at the same time, they do a blanket indigency instead of on merit. And this is where some of the shortfalls are coming in as well. The functions of water and sanitation should be handled by the same institution. In other words, you can't have sanitation and bath infrastructure with human settlements, and then you expect you're providing water from the local authority. It's two different housing and human settlements. It's a provincial function, unless the municipality has had the accreditation. And in 90% of the more than 90% of the cases, the municipalities do not have the accreditation. So therefore, the one function is run by the province, the other one is run by the local. How do you coordinate the two? It has to be done on the same level, from the same point of departure, in order to come to the same conclusion. What is the water requirement and what is the output? Because at the end of the day, the municipality is responsible for the reticulation of the wastewater. However, if the figures are not talking to each other, and they are spillages, they'll end up with the fines. If the decision was taken at a higher authority. So I think we need to look at these things so that they talk to each other and they synchronized. Thank you, James.
Thank you. Good point. Let me say good point. Mr. Who? Ms. Bengu.
Thank you, Chair. I would also apologize to go back to the issues of environment. I fully agree with the Honorable Chairperson on the issue of equitable share that is not doing its purpose, especially on water and environmental. Because with regards to the waste management in the rural and informal settlements, that they are not taken off by the municipalities, because there is also most of the illegal dumping happening where medical waste is dumped in the areas where there are people and animals. The department has no environmental inspectors who are based in municipalities to check whether the municipalities are doing something on the illegal dumping of waste management in rural areas. And also the issue of sitters that are not mentioned in the plan, because we have seen here in the country that there are more skills programs that have been done by the different sitters, but those skills, they make some of the people unemployable. But I would like to know, because there are factories which were closed in rural areas, and even now those factories are not used for economic purposes or for the people to get job opportunities, whether the planning commission is also encouraging those departments, like for instance the economic development department, to encourage the business people to open or to do the economics there, so that the people can be able to get jobs rather than to move from their areas to go to the urban areas for job opportunities. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
must engage almost all the stakeholders so that they can come up with their inputs of how to run this planning as a country. The issues of infrastructure, as we're discussing during the first round chairperson that you have given to us, I should think it's where you can feel that this department, the department that must work direct with the communities, direct with the structures, direct with local government. Because the planning that you have at national, it should be the planning that must be understood by the local government for the proper implementation of all what we have planned for this country. Thank you.
What is the question?
I'm just saying, Abafazi Mateva, you've got nothing to
do. No, I can.
No.
Thank you, Chair.
I promoted you to an Abafazi.
Of course, if there's elements of the plan that was accepted by cabinet, we would hopefully be monitoring its implementation, but not in the way that a monitoring and evaluation department would do in a more rigorous session under the presidency. So it's still an area that we ourselves are having to define, to be honest, more carefully. That's wrong. On all the other issues, take on board the comments made. I do think that Mr. Member Huang's points about the last slide and thinking about it, actually it can be a bit, I suppose it seems a bit ambitious to be able to say something like by 2030 we would like to see that no one is living in poverty. This is an aim that the Commission thinks this country must strive for. We're not saying there will be an end to poverty by 2030. Certainly, with all the full efforts and taking into consideration some of the recommendations made by the plan, we would hope that the country would see an end to it. And poverty here, very narrowly defined in terms of that poverty line, that income per month poverty line. So not broader issues of poverty, of course, a wider definition of poverty is not something, I suppose, that we could address in its full senses by 2030, but certainly that is an aim. And that goes for each of the other targets that's being set there. It's not something you're saying will happen in 2030. There are conditions that we highlight in the plan that are necessary to get to that kind of targets that we set ourselves in there. But the broader point you make about presenting Tandi's life chances in the end, how we improve it in this positive, we position the positive elements of the 2030 vision, and you're challenging us about, well, what's actually going to be the negative things is quite a useful comment to make, because we do that. We tend to present what is going to be positive in 2030, but we do not in any way necessarily highlight in an explicit way, but these are going to be the potential negatives. These are going to be the challenges that remain by 2030, and maybe the Commission, it would be useful to bring that balance into the way we present this as well. So I appreciate that comment, just by way of thinking through what we can do properly the next time. In terms of the trends in urbanization, that's urbanization would be to existing what we would define as cities and towns, but it would also be towns in rural areas or peri-urban areas as well. So the general flow from what is defined now as rural to a rural town would be part of an urbanization pattern. I'm not sure if I'm... Yeah, so there are rural towns who are not big cities and metros, etc., that exist, and that move from off rural farms, etc., into a settlement, an urban form of settlement in a rural area, is also part of that 70% trend of urbanization. It includes both. Of course, the bulk would be towards the kind of massive cities and metros, but certainly there will be an element of that. That's already happening as well in rural areas, that migration and trend towards urbanization. The others, I think, Chairperson, I will see that as comments made as well.
Ms. McCourt, any last comments from you? She was sleeping so nicely.
I wasn't sleeping, Chair. I'm talking to the DG to find where they are. Multitasking.
No, you don't have to. I'm just depending on something you wanted to.
Chair, I think from and we also started this discussion with the NPC, how we understand the different roles is that the NPC, that the two distinct roles created in the presidency of monitoring and evaluation, and the NPC on the other, the Planning Commission on the other side, is in a cycle with government departments in the three spheres. So, and it's a continuous cycle where the Planning Commission is doing the visioning, the planning, and the critiquing of the current path that we are on. that plan get adopted, partially adopted, refined, whatever government departments implement, monitoring and evaluation, monitor and evaluate, their results feed back into the cycle of planning, refinement, etc. I think where there is still a little bit of an area that needs, in terms of the future and further role post the adoption of the plan of the Planning Commission comes in, is the level of planning and the expectations in terms of the level of planning. For example, if we talk about spatial planning linking back to what different spheres of government is doing in terms of the integrated development plans, all of that, and that cycle of level and detail of planning and that influencing in terms of the planning part of it as opposed to the visioning part of the role of the commission. So I think this cycle concept is how we understood the role to be, but that level of planning, and then again, what is the role in terms of also having the inputs and impacts of the implementers, which is the government departments and the different spheres, into that reverse cycle, maybe, if I may explain it like that. And then just also to say that we are very much part of this continuous debate, and we will continue to be with the Planning Commission on the plan and the refinement of the plan.
Okay.
The one thing that I forgot is the one thing that you've mentioned in terms of where we struggled as a department in terms of what our inputs to it would be, because it affects us, is this whole focus in terms of strengthening government and this systems part. And I think that is probably a very good, and you've made some of that inputs already now in terms of how the things doesn't talk to each other. And I think portfolio parliament, generally not only this portfolio committee, but most of the portfolio committees and the select committees is in a very good position to critique where is government not efficient in terms of meeting this target. When you are in it, you have your limited role. We don't necessarily always see the links to Treasury, the links to all of these things in the position that you are in. So I think that chapter strengthening is probably a very good place where Parliament can play a very good role.
Now we can highlight the role. The problem is, I'm not sure the messages go anywhere. The problem is, some of these decisions are at a different level of government. For example, Treasury. We don't have Treasury yet. So the problem is, you can make these points, the department can enthusiastically embrace them, but they don't get decided and changed. That's what we need, someone to outside of government to start looking at this. I mean, we can play a role in identifying those issues. Each committee can identify them, but somewhere someone must say, but we've looked at this and this doesn't work. So it doesn't just come from, looks like it's one department picking on another department. So I think that's something we need to find a way of doing. Now I think the point is, in any case, is that part of why I wanted these inputs over and above acquainting ourselves with issues is that I really want us to be able to talk in the same voice. We should be careful that we don't send wrong messages, and that we should try and harmonize those stuff. And obviously where we don't agree, that's fine. We just state that and we state the alternatives. So in that sense, I think that the department and the commission on our area of work need to do a lot of work to make sure that we get this stuff to a level of finality when it goes to cabinet. Obviously, as you've suggested, Ms. Ishop, that the committee must play a role. If we're invited, we'll happily play a role. I think it would be better if we have time somewhere to sit down and where we can have time to talk about things. I mean, you know, Ms. Wenger here comes from a local government background. Some other members here come from either provincial or local government background. So they can take the kind of, not nitty-gritty stuff, which no one wants to deal with, but the kind of structural defects and problems and so on, so that we can try and get these things also across, and that the commission can play a role in showing government there are places where things are not working right and the wrong decisions have been taken. Maybe for the right reasons, but they just don't work in practice. Then the second area, and I don't want to sound too parochial when I say this, is that I do think that we as a government, and I blame us as a government, not a blame issue, I don't think that we have clearly enough identified the major role that water needs to play in all this. Let me give you some simple examples. And Mr. Morgan has touched upon it. If you actually look at our Department of Water and how they operate, a lot of decisions they take, and they take to cabinet, are because of decisions that were made in other departments. So if someone decides they're going to build a power station in Kukanap, then when there's been agreement to build the power station, then someone says, but where's the water going to come from? They say, oh, we need a dam. Then the Department of Water Affairs is given the job to make sure the dam is built. So a lot of our decisions around water, and I'm deliberately generalizing and making it simple because I want to make it like it, because I think that a lot of it is a simple thing. If you go and look at a lot of the things, if you go and look at the different projects on water, if you actually ask what motivated that, you look at it back and they say, no, but we need more water for this power station, we need more water for this thing. There is not, until the recent decision by the president to include a dam in the Transkei, I think there are very few decisions that were made for developmental reasons. So that water becomes the issue, and to what extent, by making a government decision to invest in water somewhere, will that unlock the potential, the capabilities, and the capacities in the area? I mean, we here ask the question quite a lot. I mean, the one reason why I always pick on Transkei, I think you can go to any homeland, you'll probably have the same, old homeland, you'll have the same issues. But I picked on the Transkei because I once had the opportunity with President Begi to fly over the Transkei when he was doing a Lokhotla in a helicopter. And it's just stunning. You fly from Natal and you just see water, water, water. Every little farm has got a dam graded out. And then there's some big dams that obviously government has built. And you hit that hill, the one that takes you to Transkei. You go over that hill, you will not see a drop of water again unless there's a little river running somewhere and you see a little light flash of this river. Not a single dam is built anywhere. In fact, there's always erosion everywhere. So actually, where you can see where water erodes things, you see all the erosion. Now, no one in 14, 15, 20 years that we've been in government, no one has thought, well, isn't our developmental imperative to look at a place like the Transkei or any other place where old Bantustan was? To what extent, if we provide water in this area, will it actually create capacities and capabilities for people then to empower themselves? You know, my forefathers are Boere. You go here in the Clan William, this valley here, you see how the Boere thought. The Boere said, hey, ons moet vir ons mense damme bou so hulle kan plaas hê. So what they did, they built all those canals that still today work. They built it all up that valley, put all the Boere there. Those Boere have got great farms and stuff. Wow, how do we think? Oh, no, we must be careful how we do this. No, we shouldn't be careful. We should build dams, go to places where people are, where there are not factories yet, where there is no industrial capacity. You start building dams there, you're providing water, you start creating a industry for big farms. Those big farms will immediately start generating factories because people are legit. So, I mean, I don't know much about development, me. I'm a lawyer. But I think, when I think logically, I think to myself, where will people go? It's fine to say to people, go and build your factories in Transkei or wherever, but why should they go there? But if you start creating capacity that people would want to invest money there, they'll start building around dams. They'll start building resorts. All those things. Now you start creating economy and things in that area. And the reason is because you think developmentally, how will we be able to stimulate the economy and how will you get the people going so they keep, like Ma said, yeah, stay in the rural areas, not come to... So if we don't make those decisions on developmental principles, and we make all our decisions on the basis of some decision that was made by ESCOM in a board somewhere, and where it's more comfortable for them because they want to be close to coal or so on. Now, you can immediately see that if you had, if we had a much stronger view of how we look at water as a natural resource and how will it be used as a developmental tool, if we had that and water becomes quite central to our sustainable development policy, which we will engage with the department. I see they passed this in 2005, which is already old. In 2005, you get a policy and it's now 2012. That policy is old. So now we'll enthuse a lot of new thinking in their thinking. And around those debates, I want to put water centrally. Because it is the one natural tool a government can have. Which you don't have to worry about the things that we're worrying now about mining. That some mining is good and some mining is bad. And therefore we must try to... I mean, water most of the time is just good. If you use it in the right way. It is capacitating. It creates capacities. And I really think that for me, the Commission needs to look at the issue of water more as a central tool, as a, I think you call it an agent of change or whatever. I see Rampela Mampela is also an agent of change. She doesn't belong to any party. She's an agent of change. Now, water can maybe also become an agent of change, like Rampela Mampela. And that will really be nice if we start looking at these things like that. So I really, without being parochial, because we water, I really think that it seems to me we're not putting it correctly. In fact, if you ask me, I think it should have the chapter on its own where you build a lot of what the National Planning Commission is doing around that. Because if you ask me, if we've now moved to this infrastructure, and you know, you go to anywhere in Africa, I suppose in any underdeveloped part, but you go, say, to Uganda, and you immediately see how this country is bursting with potential to do all kinds of things, but you can see that lack of infrastructure. You can just, when you go there and you sit there for a few days, you see how lack of infrastructure this stifles. I mean, they had roads built all the way to Tanzania, to the coast and so on. I mean, that place will just explode and thrive. Now, the same with us. I think we're a bit more advanced as far as that's concerned, but we have our infrastructure. So I think if we've looked at infrastructure, now we look at our natural resources. And how it becomes the central. If you want to create a new development path, and particularly depending on new technologies, the issue, you start with something that's clear and pure. You can't start with the mining, because there's a whole lot of problems with that, and with fossil fuel, a whole lot of problems. So it's there, and you have to use it. But you use something that everyone knows it's good. So I do think that's something that I would really want to see. As a much more centrally placed in the plans of the planning committee. And then lastly, just the good news to say that South Africa beat New Zealand comprehensively. Ma, we finished. Thank you, Ma. Ma, we finished. Thank you, Ma. Oh, Ma, you've had three bites at the cherry. Okay, Ma wants to speak now last.
No. Please, I'm Ma. Just saying, Chairperson, it was You have made mention of it, that it was good if the planning commission coming to address us as people from the Department of Environmental Affairs, Water and Environmental Affairs, they should have just stuck to what concerns our department. Not, you know, now we start asking, commenting on things that do not affect the department. I'm not very happy. Because as it is, I commented on education. It was just one of those exercises which where one looked stupid. So, I'm saying...
It's not a question of stupid, Mark.
Yes.
I wanted them, I asked them to give the input like that. I don't think you can understand the Planning Commission if you look at one chapter. You're not going to understand what they're trying to do. So that is why the mistake was mine. In the beginning, I should have said to Mark, let's first ask questions about our portfolio, and then we can go and enrich it on others. So we try to change that at least. But there's no, I mean, it's exactly, we want people to look at environment and water in the bigger context. Where do we want to be in 2030? There's a vision. How does water and environment fit into that vision? We have to look at it like that. So next time we'll try and structure it a little bit better, the questions and so on. But I think it's important that we have the input the same way that we had. Okay? Thank you very much, Ms. Isop and your colleague. Can I thank you very much for engaging with us. I do hope that you and the department and whoever else you engage with before June, that we get all our ducks in a row and we talk with one voice and identify where the differences are. And then the other issues we've raised, we hope that enriches the debate further. But thank you again, if you can thank the Commission as well on our behalf for being so absolutely available to engage with us. The department also, thank you. I do expect then that we'll have to make another arrangement with COP, the COP input. What I do suggest is let's have it ready for next week, so we'll try and fit it in. Next week when we do the budget vote, Ms. McCord, remember what we must concentrate on is the budget, the strategic plan, and where we're doing things wrong and so on. And then we can start dealing with other stuff as well. Okay. And the same with water. Fred, if you can tell your people, concentrate on the budget, the scoper kind of problems, and then we look at all the other stuff as well. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. From the members, anything else? All right. I don't usually make an announcement like this, but I will today because I'm lazy to call you together. NC, please remember there's a meeting today afternoon.